This morning we're looking at Nehemiah chapter 5. And if you've been with us, we've been working through a series of called A People Rebuilt. And it's a book about the return of Israel to Jerusalem after being in exile. This is the third return, the group returning, and this group is being focusing on rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. And we've talked about how the walls of Jerusalem don't represent just a physical thing, but more God's reputation, God's name, God's people representing him before the nations. And so they've been going through a process of rebuilding themselves as a people. Really, the covenant renewal is coming up. But it's a preparation for them gelling together as God's people. And I've been challenging us as a church on how is God calling us to be rebuilt. If we follow the example of Nehemiah, we take stock of the hurt and the brokenness and even God's reputation around us. And we respond to that with mourning, with fasting, with prayer. God, how are we representing you well in our day and age? Waiting on God's timing. How is God leading us forward? And what doors is he opening? What doors is he closing? How are we rallying together as a team? Are we doing this together? Are we really bonded together as a people? Have we dedicated ourselves to the task? Has each one been involved? As one chapter says, you know, everyone works on their part of the wall according to family and associations. Is everyone involved? As we talked last week, that, you know, whatever we get involved in, there's going to be much opposition. We hear about that, you know, with CIM and other ministries. Whether it's spiritual warfare, taking down our physical abilities or spiritual awareness or whatever, sometimes it's opposition among the people that we're working. And really, we are called to be a people with one hand on the sword and one hand on the trowel. We're on a spiritual level that we are in tune with God's heart, but our hands are involved in the work that he's called us to do. There's this interesting dynamic between the sovereignty of God and the movement of God and the Spirit of God doing what only the Spirit can do, yet the people of God, which is us, committing ourselves to serve the way that God has called us to serve and equipped us to serve. And so that's what we talked about last week, that we are to be a people that have one hand on the sword, one hand on the trowel, and we're just following his lead. So there's dangers from without. This morning I want to talk about something that is prevalent in any church, in any body, but seldom, I would suggest, really addressed, and that's the danger within. The danger that's within us as a body, within us as a people. Ingrid, I'm not sure if I put that little stick into the computer. Yep, thanks. And then if you could click forward for me. There's a danger among the people of God, and we seldom recognize it. You know, if we look at a building, if you walk around your home and you find a crack in the foundation, that's pretty worrisome. It should be, anyway. When you think of the weight and everything that's been built on top of a foundation, it's pretty important. Quite often in congregations, in churches, in movements, in families, there's cracks in the foundation of who we are, and we fail to address them. And not too long later, things start to fall apart. They start to collapse. And many of you have been a part of that story within churches, within families, within movements, within ministries. That everything starts to crumble, and we ask the question, why? Well, what's going on? Well, there's a crack in the foundation, and usually we want to secure the home from powerful winds that we had this week, or storms, or rain, or whatever. But we seldom look on the inside of really what's amongst us that's dangerous. And you know, when a people pursue a vision or something that God's put before them, and the pressure and the weight of that starts to hit, it reveals these cracks. It reveals what's been hidden beneath the surface. And things start to emerge. And we see that with many people, many churches. If you have a building project or something like that, people, you'll rally behind that. But soon after, tensions arise, splits happen, people leave. Why is that? Is it because a vision is a bad thing? Or a building project is wrong or whatever? No, it's not. The problem is we haven't addressed the dangers within. We kind of avoid those, and we avoid them by pursuing some vision that attracts people. But really, as the people of God, we have to have a perspective on what's happening in us, among us. Are we truly a people that are united by the finished work of Christ? And so this morning I want to talk about the danger within the body. And we see that happen with in Nehemiah's time. We see that, you know, those pursuing self-interest among us basically re-enslave those who've already been freed in Christ. I'm going to explain that. Last week I talked about, you know, us being sent out like sheep among the wolves. But, you know, so often we just devour ourselves. You kind of wonder if the wolves sit back and go, hey, this is kind of entertaining, because they're self-destructing. Jesus sent us out as a unified flock to serve among a broken people. And when we actually pursue a vision of God and with God's power, then yes, we are faced with the wolves. But as I talked about last week, we've been given the armor of God to survive that. Good conflict happens in churches. There's always conflict. You get two people together, there's going to be a conflict. Conflict is actually great. The problem is when there's something within us that's self-serving, that we start to devour one another. To re-enslave, I'm not talking about, you know, you're still under the curse of sin or something like that. That sin still has power over you. But what I'm talking about this morning is that when there is faction or division within the body, when people are pursuing self-interest within a ministry or vision of a church, what we start to do is hamstring and limit the gifts, the abilities, the time, the energy, the resources of people who really do want to pursue a vision of God. And in that way, it feels very enslaving. When we are held back because of self-interest, it's as if we've been enslaved again. We are not experiencing the freedom of Christ. We see that play out in the people here in Nehemiah's time. So last week, we looked at chapter 4 and chapter 6 and how the dangers from without, people challenging this ministry or this work of building the wall. Starting in chapter 5, in between these two, we see the dangers within. The first few verses. Now the men and the wives raised a great outcry against the Jewish brothers. Notice that word. Some were saying, we and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain. Others were saying, we are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, our homes to get grain during the famine. Still others were saying, we have had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards, although we are of the same flesh and blood as our countrymen, and though our sons are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others. Okay, what's happening here? We see three examples that point us to a greater issue. We got three people. The first one is people who don't have land, and they're dependent on work and things like that to gain money, to buy grain, to eat. The building of the wall is taking some of that time and energy away. We have a second group that has land, but they're having to mortgage against it to pay, pay taxes and things like that. The second group is people who are mortgaging against their property to buy land or to buy food, but they're unable to do that. The third group is landowners who are so in debt they're having to borrow money to pay taxes. So we have three groups that are in debt, not able to meet their needs. What is the source of that debt? We see in the context of this chapter that it's actually fellow Jews. It's people, their own people, who are demanding that they pay tax on any kind of loans, any kind of borrowing, to mortgage their fields so that they can buy grain from somebody who is of their family. So this is pointing to this idea of taking advantage of one another, self-interest. We'll see throughout this chapter and other chapters these words brothers, countrymen, flesh and blood, people taking advantage of one another because of their own self-interest. It's getting so bad that we can see that their children are being sold into slavery. Now, this is something that wasn't uncommon at the time. If you couldn't pay a debt, you would sell your child to work for that debt, and eventually they could be repaid and purchased back. But we see in verse 5 that some of this has already happened, and if we look carefully at the language here, there's a sexual overtone to this. That children have been sold into sexual slavery so that needs can be met. This reminded me of an experience that I've had in Uganda. If you go to bordering Uganda and Kenya is a lake called Lake Victoria. And it's a popular place. It's a beautiful lake, actually. It's the source of the Nile River. And a lot of people make their living of fishing there. And when we were working with the African mission that we used to be associated with, we learned about the plight of people around the lake as well as people on Asese Islands within the lake. We heard that women and children who would sell fish on the shores and in markets were dependent on men catching fish in the lake. But because there were so many that wanted to get involved in that business, the men would start to abuse their power and their position. And they would only sell their catch to the women and the children that would sleep with them. And so when we were working there, the HIV/AIDS rate within the Sese Islands was 95%. When people are in position of need, they get exploited. If you watch the news regarding the hurricane seasons, whether it's Katrina or the more recent ones, if you look carefully in some of the news reports there, the rescuers will go to a home with someone on the roof and will exploit them then and there before they are rescued. This is common. So your fellow countrymen, your flesh and blood, as it were, your brothers, we're taking advantage of people in vulnerable situations. And quite frankly, I mean, maybe some of that isn't happening within the church, but the motivation, the heart that drives people to do that is the same as if it's in the church. It's self-interest. My plan, what makes me feel good, what affirms me. We see a people here taking advantage of God's people for their own interests, putting them in vulnerable situations, and basically enslaving people that have been purchased as God's people. You know, I think of an example of an autoimmune disease. This is a problem the church has. When you think of the gift of your immune system is a gift for you to fight invasions into your body. So if your body detects a bacteria or something like that in your body, it raises up an army, right, to fight against that. And HIV/AIDS actually takes away that immune system, and you pass away of some other kind of disease. But there's many, many different autoimmune diseases. It's when your body, instead of fighting foreign invaders, turns on itself and invades itself. There's many examples. Lupus, multiple sclerosis, diabetes, all of these are conditions where your body turns on itself and starts to break itself down. And I can't help but see the analogy there of the church, where people, resources have been given to the church to be used for God's glory, yet we so quickly turn and invade each other. Nehemiah sees this, and in verse 6, he's outraged. When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. Quite often we attribute anger to sin, and rightfully so, but there is anger that is appropriate. There's a righteous anger that comes out here. He sees the injustice against his people, the people of God, and what it's doing to their vision of being rebuilt as a people. And so he's angry. I have a mentor who I actually saw for the first time in a long time just last week, and I distinctly remember one time sitting with him. I like to ask tough questions. Some of you know that. And so I was sitting there, and I looked at him. He didn't share his life with many people, but I remember looking at him one day and said, "What makes you angry?" I wanted to rile him up a little bit. What makes you angry? What gets you passionate? And he told me what makes him angry is when people thwart the mission and the vision of God. And being in my role now and in ministry for a while, I share that anger. I get angry when I see people of self-interest thwarting what God wants to do through a movement of people. And, you know, some of you have come to know Christ through this church, or, you know, think back to the times that you came to know Christ, and that's what's at stake when people come into a body and pursue their self-interest. We get angry with that because this isn't about us. It's about God's name and God's reputation. And so he gets angry at this. There's a righteous anger because he knows it's enslaving God's people and preventing them from being what God has intended them to be. So this morning, I want to challenge us that, you know, how we view each other There's three dimensions here. How we view each other reveals our reverence for God to the world. Okay, there's three dimensions there. How we view God, our reverence for God, impacts how we see one another. That's the second dimension. And how we see one another and how we interact with one another is actually a witness to the world. So on our bulletin boards out there, you can see that Brightview connects with God, with one another, and with the world. We're supposed to be three-dimensional in our living. And we see that play out here. How we view and value and treat one another reveals really our reverence for God, our heart for God. And in doing that, it's going to create a witness to people around us. Nehemiah goes through a process of revealing that to his people. One is always a function of the other. Reverence for God, reverence for one another, reverence for people. In verse 7, we see Nehemiah pondering this. Just as a bit of a side lesson here, a great practice in not responding immediately when God puts something on your heart. He restrains himself. He said in verse 7, I ponder them in my mind. And before you respond to something too soon, we see this in chapter 1, taking time for God to deepen a discontent or deal with it. And so he is brought to a time of responding, and he challenges people. He brings to light that each of us have been purchased by debt or from debt slavery. I'm going to explain what that means. Let's look at verse 7 and 8. So I pondered them in my mind and then accused the nobles and the officials. I told them, you are exacting usury. Now that is tax that is really high, unusual high tax from your own countrymen. So I called together a large meeting to deal with them and said, as far as possible, we have bought back our Jewish brothers who were sold to the Gentiles. Now are you selling your brothers only for them to be sold back to us? What is he saying here? He's probably speaking about Jewish people who've been sold into slavery through the exile or through being in debt. So if you are in debt to somebody, you sell yourself to work it off. In the Levitical law, we can see that if somebody is sold to a Gentile because they have debt, that person can be redeemed. That person can be purchased back into the fold from that debt, from that slavery. And so Nehemiah, as far as we can see here, that he and his brothers and so on have been purchasing these people back to be a part of the people of God. But now some are in debt to fellow Jews who are then selling them into slavery to pay off that debt. So they're basically reversing what has already been done, that these people have been purchased out of slavery and they're being sent back into slavery by their own brothers, by their own flesh and blood, as it were, their own countrymen. And he made it clear that that was unacceptable. To this, they had nothing to say because they knew they were guilty. This happens, by the way, after we ponder things. If we need to go approach somebody, taking the time to ponder what we need to be said, that it's not about me, it's me being angry, but actually coming up with a true argument, it leads people to be silent because they're guilty. I kind of wonder what the church is. What are we as a church? We talk about being brothers and sisters. Sometimes, not jokingly, but hey, brother, I come up and see somebody. Why can we say that? We've been purchased into a family. We have been brought into a new family. That's the amazing thing about the church when we function as a church. If you come from a broken home, abusive parents, absent parents, when you come to know Christ, you are brought into a new family. And it's an amazing thing to be a part of. The first thing I spoke on when I came to Brightview 6.5 years ago was going through the book of 1 Peter. And why I did that is because Peter talks about being brought into the family. He uses a lot of what we call household language. And so I wanted to affirm us as a body, as a place to start, that we are brothers and sisters in Christ, and we've been purchased to be a part of a family, to pursue something beyond ourselves. And another big thing in Timothy is honor. Don't seek honor from one another. Don't seek honor from our world, because in due course, God's going to honor us as brothers and sisters, as children of God. And so Peter talks about this idea of debt slavery, that we owed a debt to God, and through Christ we have been purchased to be a part of a new family. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 18 to 22 says this, "For you know that it was not with perishable things, such as silver or gold, that you were redeemed, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. Now that you have purified yourselves by obeying the truth, so that you have sincere love for your brothers. Love one another deeply from the heart." So go back here. Peter's talking about us being in debt to God through sin, because of sin. But we have been redeemed. The word redeemed means to purchase back, to buy back, to pay a ransom. And why? So that we can love one another. So that we can be a part of a body. So that we can love one another deeply from the heart, Peter says. We've been purchased to be a part of a great movement. But so often the disunity within the church, the selfishness, the abuse of one another, we've seen in so many churches, basically throws us back into slavery, debt slavery, in some way, that we are prevented to function as the people of God. You know, the body of Christ matters. Have you ever thought about that simple term? The church matters. It matters a lot because it's the only plan God's got. He takes a dynamic group of people. He buys them through the precious blood of Christ. He bonds them together through this finished work. And he calls them to something beyond themselves. And all of us are here this morning in some way because the body has touched my heart. The body has changed my life. God doesn't work just through his Spirit. But through his Spirit, he calls people to speak into our lives. He bonds us together to this body. And so we've been purchased from a debt slavery. And the danger within us is that we fall back into that because it becomes about me. This group of people were functioning that way. Nehemiah brought that to light. They knew what he was talking about. And it was so convicting, verse 8, they kept quiet. They had nothing to say. Because they knew they were guilty. Nehemiah brings it to climax by really highlighting what is wrong here. It's not a money issue. It's not a financial issue. It's not even just a community issue. This is a spiritual issue. It's a lifestyle or it's a heart lacking reverence for God. Verse 9 to 11. He knew they didn't say anything, so he continued. What you're doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? As I've said, verse 10, I and my brothers and my men are also lending the people money and grain, but let the exacting of this high tax usury stop. Give back to them immediately their fields, their vineyards, olive groves and houses, and also the usury you are charging them, the 100th part of the money, grain, new oil, a new wine and oil. Why are they doing this? He highlights it in verse 9. I think this is the climax of the passage. Shouldn't you walk in fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? What's he saying here? He's saying that we're lacking awe. We're lacking devotion. We're lacking a sense of truly this amazing God that we follow and our accountability to him. In other translations, maybe if you missed it in this NIV version, you know, putting in a little more easier English, the New Living Translation says, should you not walk in fear of our God in order to avoid being mocked by our enemies? Do you notice how our reverence for God says something to our community, to the people who don't believe? And they say, if you don't even revere God and treat one another, you guys are a joke. They're mocking us. In the message, is there no fear of God left in you? Don't you care what the nations around here, our enemies, think of you? if our heart was truly about God's reputation, God's name going out, God transforming the lives of broken people, we would see our relationship with one another different. We'd see our relationship with God different, because we'd see that those two dimensions dramatically impact our witness. And so when there's factions within the church, when there's fracture within the church, when there's selfishness, when there's self-interest being played out, when we're not willing to reconcile with one another, we're lacking reverence for God who has made us and bought us and formed us into a body. And we actually also don't care about our witness. Shouldn't you walk in fear of our God to avoid the mockery of our enemies? There's a genuine need here. Verse 10, he says, we're contributing. We're giving to this, but we're not demanding tax. We're not holding them slavery to this. It becomes a gift. So, you know, Jennifer talked about it. There's a ministry of giving gifts to people who are struggling in this time, and that's appropriate. It's good to come alongside one another. The book of Acts, which we've gone through, you know, in chapter 6, it talks about the one anotherness of the church, where all of their possessions were shared. No one had need. And why people don't have that is because they don't function with fear. And when I talk about fear, I'm talking about reverence. I'm talking about awe. I'm talking about a respect for God. And so our lifestyle is defined by this reverence for God. And it plays out in how we commit to one another. So we've been purchased from a debt slavery. Our lifestyle is defined as fear. Our lifestyle is a function of our reverence for God. And finally, we see that there's a commitment to one another. So a little earlier in this passage, he calls all these people together. He challenges them to give back everything. Do not charge tax. Do not hold people ransom. And in verse 12, we see, we will give it back. We see a public declaration among everybody. We will not demand anything more of them. We will do as you say. Nehemiah continues, then I summoned the priests and made the nobles and the officials take an oath, a commitment, a promise to do what they had promised. I also shook out the folds of my robe and said, in this way may God shake out of his house, notice the family language there, and possessions every man who does not keep his promise. So may such man be shaken out and emptied. So we have to kind of go with the Old Testament garb. They had long robes that were held together by a tie. And as you tie, you could have a little fold in there, almost like my shirt here. And they would carry things in those folds. And so what he was dramatically showing and was kind of throwing everything out of those folds and saying, if we don't commit to one another, when we don't follow through with treating God's people out of reverence for God, the implication is God's going to shake you out. You're not a part of this family anymore. That's not how you treat your brothers or sisters. That's not how you care for people of the same blood, the blood of Christ, your blood brothers, family. People were willing to call themselves and make this promise to one another. Verse 13 continues on and says, at this, the whole assembly said, amen. Which means, may it be that way, may it be so, just like that. And what did they do? They praised the Lord. They worshiped. They started a worship service. Remember, back in the very first sermon in this whole series, what is God's heart about? It's about reverence. It's about worship. It's about praise. It's about us being everything God has called us to be. And they get restored to that as a people. Something that is sometimes awkward or challenging for me is to speak respectfully but unapologetically about things like baptism and membership. You have it in the bulletin. There's been little reply cards in the bulletin for you. This is why. When we come to faith in God, it's never private. It is a transaction that goes on between God and I, but it's within the context of God's people. And baptism is just a way of declaring this faith to my brothers and sisters, to the family to which that I now belong. It's like a homecoming, walking in the living room and saying, I'm home because I've been purchased by the blood of Christ. We're brothers and sisters. We're of the same blood now. We're living for the same reasons, and that's all baptism is. And it's a graphic testimony of, I am dead to sin. I've gone into the grave. I'm 6 feet under. I am crucified with Christ, but now in him I live. And together we live in him. We've been redeemed. We've been purchased from this debt slavery. That's what baptism does. How do we know that we're of the same thing unless there's a testimony among us? And it's really quite sad that in church history we've taken salvation and separated it from this public declaration called baptism and this inclusion into the community of believers. We've separated all that. And I don't think that's the biblical model. When I come to know Jesus, I declare it to my brothers and sisters and to the world so they know what I'm about. And in doing so, I've made a promise that we are shoulder to shoulder together. And we walk as brothers and sisters. We engage in the war that God has called us to with one hand on the sword, one on the trowel. We're doing it together as the family of God. Yet we've broken it up in the church. And so why is there so much faction? Why is there no commitment? Why is there so much conflict? Why is there so little engagement? It's because we haven't dedicated ourselves to one another. And so I continue to invite you to make public your commitment to follow Jesus and your commitment to one another that we are doing this together and I'm accountable to you. And in doing so, our world will see our reverence for God and reverence for one another. And that's when mission happens. You want to see ministries happen? You see this on the mission field a lot. There is no one else to rely on. And you can't make it on your own. And so you're so dependent on your brothers and sisters who have given their lives for the sake of the gospel. Quite frankly, it's no different for us here. We're missionaries. We're living in a mission field. But because we speak the same language and we were born here, we don't see it that way. But this is a mission field. Jesus, when he was mandating what we're to be about and giving us a new command, he talks about loving God and loving one another. This new command I give you, love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples. This command I give you, love one another. This commitment to one another is our ministry. By this, they will know we are disciples of Jesus Christ. And to this, the whole assembly says, yes, let it be so. That's the kind of movement I want to be about. Because every kind of family I ever join betray me in some way. It's always about them. It falls apart. There's no means of grace and mercy. There's no means or way of reconciliation. That's all found in the purchased blood of Christ. And so I'm calling us to be a people where we value each other so much that we reveal our reverence for God and we commit to one another. And in doing so, our mission will happen. We see that play out here. And that's our take home. That effectiveness in mission emerges out of our generosity to one another. Everyone commits to this. They praise, they worship. And then Nehemiah kind of adds some additional information. I won't probably read it all here. But he basically says his life as governor of Jerusalem. So at some point in here, we don't know when, he becomes the governor of Jerusalem. And he is for 12 years. And now, as you can imagine, as a government official, he's given a budget for food and things like that. And he says that it was a great heavy burden, verse 15. He says that, you know, all of this was a heavy burden on people. And people who held this position before lorded that over all the people. They did it boldly. But notice what happens with Nehemiah. The end of verse 15. But out of reverence for God, don't skip over that. Reverence for God, I did not act like that. These are God's people. Why would I take, this is my right, but why would I take advantage of my brothers and sisters in this way if it was a burden to them? Instead, verse 16, I devoted myself to the work on this wall. Remember what the wall represents. God's name, God's reputation, God's vision. I devoted myself to that. All my men were assembled there for the work. We did not acquire any land. It was not about us. The work continued. The mission continued because he was being generous to his own people. It continues on how he would host people. As a governor, he would have to do that. But he did it because there was a heavy burden, verse 18, on people. He gave generously out of his own reserves. He did it out of reverence for God and a focus on his mission. So a couple takeaways for us this morning. This will not be new, but I hope, and a lot of what I say, it might not be new, but I hope you explore it through a new depth. And that the essential is that we love God. You know, everybody says, love God, love people, serve the world. You can find that in a gazillion mission statements on any church website. I'm calling you to love God. Reverence, fear, awe, submission, acknowledging that we're going to be held accountable to this God. That's what Nehemiah is talking about in verse 15. Out of reverence for God, I did not do this because I'm going to be held accountable for this one day. This is my brothers and sisters, and God's going to say, what did you do with the opportunities I gave you in serving with the people that I gave you? When Jesus talked about the greatest commandment, what was the first one? Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, all of your mind, all of your soul, all of your... Do you notice the alls there? The all-encompassedness to this? Everything of you is given over to God. Love is sacrificial. This isn't what our world's talking about, love. Giving him everything. Reverence, fear, submission, awe. If you don't have that in place, the rest falls apart. Secondly, love one another. We love people. What plays out in these last verses of chapter 5 is Nehemiah's compassion. He sees his people through new eyes. He sees the heavy burden. He sees people hungry, people feeling disjointed from the body that they've come back to, and he serves them sacrificially. We see his selflessness. He freely feeds them and provides for them. These are the two commandments. Love God. Love your neighbor. Jesus says, in this, you fulfill the law. We talked about that in Sunday school this morning. What is the law? And the whole Old Testament articulates what this law was and the heavy burden of it. And Jesus says, you want to know how to fulfill that? You don't want to know what it looks like to be right with me? Love me. And just love people. Serve them as I would. That sums up the law and the prophets. So these are two essentials. We'll have an opportunity to respond to those in a moment. But finally, as we move forward as a church, there's going to be a lot demanded of us. The congregational meeting coming up in a few weeks, we invite you to be a part of that because we'll be talking about what our future holds and some of the challenges and great opportunities that are before us, but really what it's going to cost us as well. And in doing that, as we move forward, we have to surrender the right to gain. This isn't about me. Even if I do have the right, I surrender it. The Christian life is all about surrender. It's all about sacrifice. It's all about otherness. It's costly. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, it's a fantastic chapter. Maybe it's because of the position I hold, but Paul goes through this incredible dialogue of what he has the right to as an apostle. And he says, all of that he lays down. I become the Jew to the Jew. I become the poor to the poor. He becomes anything, all things to all people, so that they might come to know Jesus. He surrenders them. I have become all things to all man, so that by all means, notice the all's there again, I might save some. But at the end of that, he puts the vision. I do this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. You're surrendering the right to gain for a while. In this lifetime, remember the honor in 1 Peter. I don't want honor here. I don't want riches here. I don't want affirmation here. You know why? Because I want to share in the blessings of the gospel. Nehemiah understood that. He ends this with this quick little prayer. Again, prayer is a huge thing within Nehemiah, but he gives all this. He gives an apology for reverence for God and service for one another. Well, why would I want to do that? What's in it for me? He says this little prayer that's very insightful. Verse 19, remember me with favor. oh God, for all I have done for these people. Who is he looking to? Where's his gain? It's the gain yet to come. It's not in this lifetime. When God comes and restores all things and everything are brought back under his kingship, that is when favor comes out. That's when gain comes for people who follow Christ. So let's surrender the game today, because we know in due time we will share in the blessings of the gospel. Now, the beauty of the gospel is that there are blessings today. As many of you have been a part of someone's journey, brought some to come to know Christ or whatever, and there's nothing greater than that. So there is blessing today, but there is one yet to come. The gain comes later. Remember me, Father, with favor, because I just want to hear your voice say, well done.